Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
All right, as we continue today in Zechariah chapter 9, the first chapter in that part of the prophet's book that for some time has been labeled 2nd Zechariah, we need to keep the bigger picture in mind. Otherwise, we're going to get lost in all the complex nuances of these passages. And the chief characteristic of chapter 9 is that it is nearly all Hebrew poetry. Therefore, many words are chosen for their poetic value, which in many ways can make it more difficult to ascertain its meaning in the minds of people who lived so very long ago. Now, from that larger picture, we also see that chapters 9 through 14 deal primarily with the future from the vantage point of Zechariah's time. And these chapters were written several years after chapters 1 through 8. And while chapters 1 through 8 mainly deal with Judah and the Judeans of the Babylonian exile returning to the land, chapters 9 through 14 have much to do with what we call the 10 lost tribes, who formed the kingdom of Ephraim, also known as the Northern Kingdom, what had yet to return to their land. Now, an additional needed part of our perspective is that when God uses the human hand and mind to describe the far future, and the human hand and mind is what God uses in all books of the Bible, then all that can be said necessarily uses words that must exist in their current vocabulary, and concepts that must exist in their current culture at the same time it was written. I mean, that's hardly a primitive conundrum. We do exactly the same thing today because we face exactly the same situation when even our futurists attempt to look far ahead. Our challenge then is to try to understand what those words and concepts meant to convey those thousands of years ago, because that is what God intended. And it is what we need to know in our day and beyond. Therefore, we'll continue to look pretty deeply into the nuances and technicalities behind these passages so to get it as right as we can. Even so, some things we're going to have to be satisfied with knowing there may be more than one way to properly understand these words. After all, we are likely studying ancient words meant to describe something that's only happening now, or will happen in but a few years ahead of us. Better to know what was intended, even if it flies in the face of long-cherished doctrines, than to believe and expect something that is far off track. So let's reread just a small section of Zechariah chapter 9. Open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 9. We're going to start reading at verse 11. Verse 11. Also you, by the blood of your covenant, I release your prisoners from the dungeon, the cistern that has no water in it. Return to the stronghold, you prisoners, with hope. This day I declare to you that I will grant you a double reparation. For I have bent Judah as my bow and made Ephraim its arrow. I will rouse your sons, Zion, and make you like a warrior's sword against your sons, Greece. Adonai will appear over them, and his arrow will flash like lightning. Adonai Elohim will blow the shofar and go out in the whirlwinds of the south. Adonai Sefaot will defend them. They will devour and trample the sling stones. They will drink and roar as if they had drunk wine. They will be filled like basins and like the corners of the altar. On that day, Adonai, their God, will save them as the flock of his people, for they will be like gems in a crown, sparkling over his countryside. What wealth is theirs, what beauty! grain will make the young men thrive, and new wine the young women. Now, we've already looked closely at verse 11. However, I want to highlight a single word to speak about for just a moment. And that word is covenant, in Hebrew, berith. Now, while much, maybe most of the time in the Bible, that word covenant is used. In the times when it speaks about those covenants in which God offers it and is directly one of the parties to that covenant, it has a legal and spiritually binding aspect to it that rises above any agreements that humans enter into between one another. And that is the case even when the oath that is sworn to seal that covenant invokes Yahweh as the guarantor. So, on the other times when the term covenant is used, it is automatically less forceful and unbreakable. Any good Hebrew lexicon will inform us that the term berith, covenant, also means allegiance or agreement. And those other covenants fall more in line with earthbound standard allegiances and agreements. I'm going to leave that unfinished topic there for now. In chapters 10 and 11, that matter becomes more of a challenging issue. But here in chapter 9, this blood covenant no doubt is referring to a God-offered, God as one of the direct parties type of a covenant, the most forceful and unbreakable kind, which necessarily leads us to one more important nuance we must get firmly squared away in our minds. When we read the word unbreakable or break in the Bible, or we assign that term to a covenant, even if a passage doesn't actually have it there, it usually doesn't mean how most it is most often taken. Most Bible commentators say that to break a covenant means to terminate it. Okay, that isn't always correct. To get the correct meaning, it must be taken in context. For instance, in modern times, a common phrase is, "You broke the law." It certainly does not mean that a law or even an entire law code has been terminated. It simply means that you broke the terms or the instruction of a law. And when that happens, there are prescribed consequences, penalties, for the party that has broken it. In Bible speak, when one breaks a covenant, especially one with God, then curses are involved. We need to simply see this ancient word as meaning penalties. So in the Bible, when we read of God telling the Israelites that the covenant has been broken, it does not mean that that covenant has been terminated. Such a termination is not one of the prescribed consequences for breaking its terms. To be clear, there is no action serious enough for God to abolish the substance of the Abrahamic or the Mosaic covenants, nor the so-called New Covenant, which is really but a relocation of God's laws and commands from a sheepskin scroll to a worshiper's own mind and spirit, a kind of a renewal for the Mosaic Covenant. Now, I fully realize I'm in the minority on that matter, but I also recognize that the majority that insists otherwise bases that on the unyielding belief that Yeshua abolished the covenant of Moses, meaning, therefore, that all covenants of God, even if we're told they're forever, can be ended if there's sufficient cause. In other words, a church doctrine was established about covenants that allows God to abolish them, and then it has been used retroactively to define what breaking a covenant actually means in the Bible. Now, what is so nefarious about this is that it then makes the liar out of prophets like Zechariah, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and others. They bring us God's message that he will never abandon his children, Israel, nor will he ever abolish his covenant with them, but according to that church doctrine, he turns around and does it anyway. Now, please keep all this in mind as we go forward, because that's the basis from which I will speak. So now let's jump to verse 13. This verse begins using a war implement, the bow and arrow, as a metaphor for how he intends to use Israel to defeat Gentile nations who come against them. Now notice how the prophet breaks Israel down into two entities, Judah and Ephraim. That is, the people who come from the kingdom of Judah and the people who come from the kingdom of Ephraim, who together form the whole kingdom of Israel. Judah is illustrated as a war bow, Ephraim its arrow. What this means is that God will not be fighting the Gentile nations by himself, supernaturally defeating as he did with Sodom and Gomorrah, but rather will use Israel as his proxy. This, of course, is a standard pattern, as God uses other proxies like Babylon, Assyria, to punish Israel by making war on his own people. Now, I want to highlight that using Judah and Ephraim as a couplet is meant to convey exactly the same thing as using Jerusalem and Ephraim, or even House of Judah and House of Joseph as couplets. Used together, these all mean the entirety of Israel, all the tribes. Now, the prophet says that God will stir up the sons of Zion. Here we see how Zion can be such an elastic term in the Bible. Zion, which most often means Jerusalem, sometimes and in times Jerusalem, that is trending towards a restored spiritual condition, here it means all Israel. And yet, at the same time, we're told that this stirred up Zion will make war against Javan, in later times it's called Greece. Therefore, this stirs up a debate about whether this is speaking about an end times Zion or it is referring to Israel resisting Alexander the Great. Others think this is referring to the Maccabean era, when in 164 BC, the Jews gained their independence from the Syrians and from Antiochus Epiphanes. In fact, we even have scholars that dislike this conundrum so much that they would prefer to just eliminate the part about Israel coming against Greece, claiming it had to be an after-the-fact addition that happened subsequent to Greece attacking the Holy Land in the mid-late 4th century. Now, I see this as merely predicting a prophecy to happen in the way that nearly all prophecies usually do. They are fulfilled at least twice, often three times. Each time, their fulfillment expands in scope and scale from local to universal. In later times, Greece, Javan, became a catchword among the Jews to speak of all unfriendly Gentile nations to Israel, just as Canaanite became a catchword meaning merchants. This because to the Jews, merchants were pretty much relegated to the same derogatory social status as tax collectors. It was a pretty nasty epithet. Now, while it may be that this prophecy includes, as a partial fulfillment, Israel fighting against Alexander's Greek army, this was not a case of an independent Israel fighting to stay independent. At this time, Persia still controlled Israel. And it was mainly the Persian army that fought the Greek army over Judah. So as victors, Greece merely usurped Persia as rulers over Israel, over Judah in reality. The Maccabean-led victory, they gave Judah its independence back for about a century, might be it, although it certainly is not a victory over the Greeks, as the prophecy states. Further, this use of the term Zion, meaning all of Israel, is a bit strange. So I think that it is not likely that the Greek war had anything to do with this prophecy. Probably not the Maccabean rebellion either, because the Zion described in this verse consists of both Judah and Ephraim. Ephraim had yet to return to the land. And now, only now, in the 21st century, are they returning to their homeland in any recognizable way. Rather, it is that the mention of Javan was more meant as Javan symbolizing the entire Gentile world who comes against Israel in the end times. Babylon is used this way in the New Testament. Zion, most often meaning Jerusalem in a redeemed condition, but then in this passage, adding the element of a reunited Israel makes more sense. Bottom line, I see this only as an end times prophecy because it is yet to happen. Now, verse 13 ends with words that the army of Zion will be like an army made up of elite warriors, Giborim, mighty men. That is, Israel is going to be militarily very strong when they go to war with the Gentile nations. I cannot ignore what is happening now as we open the new year of 2025 at the now fully revealed strength of Israel's army in defeating their enemies, Hezbollah and Hamas, and soon, I suspect, the Houthis of Yemen. And in doing so, they have greatly degraded Iran, and it even caused the Assad monarchy of Syria to fall. This all occurring while the nations of the Gentile world sat back timidly, wringing their hands. The world now knows, and this is not good news to them, that Israel is a very formidable armed force. Sounds a great deal like this prophecy of Zechariah 9:13, doesn't it? Only time will tell if this is the case. Now, the first words of verse 14 obscure a reality in virtually all English Bibles. It begins, "and the Lord." That is not what the Hebrew says. It says, "and Yehovah." This is important. This is speaking of the Father. Yeshua is not Jehovah. And many Bible commentators have stepped to say, this verse is speaking of Christ. And they do it because the English Bible say, the Lord. And we all know that within the church, the Lord has become synonymous with Jesus Christ. Replacing that with the original Yehovah proves that the Lord is a poor translation that misleads. Now, saying that Yehovah will appear over them, meaning over Zion, seems to indicate a theophany, an appearance of God. How that looks to the eye is hard to say. We read in Exodus that God appeared in a burning bush. He also appeared as a dark cloud and lightning over Mount Sinai. So exactly how he will be perceived, how he will be seen, is left open to the imagination. Then it speaks of God sending forth his arrow. Now, even though nothing is said of a bow, because in the previous verse, bow and arrow were used together to describe a common instrument of war, we should take the term arrow when used all by itself as meaning the same thing. In this case, God is the metaphorical bow. That said, then what is God's instrument of war, the arrow, in this case? What is it? Now, I have a hard time believing this means a militarily strong Zion, because that has already been addressed. So a reasonable question is, well, then who or what is God's arrow? Could that symbolize the returning Messiah? Or maybe that's too specific. What makes me suspect that the arrow is the Messiah is the mention of lightning, the sudden return of Yeshua coming in the clouds, a true theophany. Then the blowing of a shofar, which is a battle cry, that also is said to herald the return of Yeshua. And then finally, the idea of a whirlwind, which indicates an unstoppable force that disrupts. I can't say with certainty that the arrow is Yeshua, but I don't know of a better candidate, all things considered. In any case, storms are the metaphorical backdrop for a theophany. And as we think about prior theophanies, they usually include dark clouds, lightning, the blasting of a horn or shofar, and wind. The mention of winds of the south, the in verse 14, is like saying hurricane, if you live in a coastal city, or Santa Ana winds, if you live in Southern California. In the Holy Land region, it was the southern winds that brought the most intense and destructive storms. So south doesn't seem to have any special spiritual significance here. It just reflects intensity. Moving on to verse 15, we read Yehovah of hosts, which cements that it is Yehovah that is the figure of the theophany that appears over Zion, not Yeshua. Here it is not only that God will use Israel as an instrument of war, but also that he will protect them. Now, this merely doubles down on whose side God is fighting. From Genesis to Revelation, God's people and God's covenant people are always Israel. He may remove his presence from them for a time. He might open the door to foreign invaders. He could bring bad weather and drought to the land. But these are all penalties set down in the Mosaic Covenant should Israel break certain rules and laws of that covenant, no matter. His bottom line promise is he will never permanently abandon his people, nor will he make some other people his replacement of Israel. Rather, because God defends Israel, then they will simply overwhelm their attackers. They will roar like lions and devour their enemies. And while there are varying views on what the Hebrew word avnei kelah means, seems to be a combination of stones and slings, so sling stones is suggested, yet the point is pretty clear. These are the enemy warriors. The enemy warriors will be well armed, but they still will lose decisively. To drink and be boisterous is to have great confidence. This is not about drunkenness or partying. Now, when we read that they will be filled like basins, like the corners of the altar, this now takes on a spiritual aspect. The Hebrew word used here for basins is misrach, and it is referring to the ritual basins used in temple ceremonies. Now, I'm not sure what the intent is of speaking of the corners of the altar, of which there are four, beyond the fact that this obviously speaks of the temple altar or the altar of burnt offering. Basins are filled. The altar is used to present sacrificial offerings to God. So it seems that the warriors are being held up sacrificially to God. This does not mean sacrificially in the sense of them being slaughtered and burned up, but rather in dedicating their warrior service to God. They are fighting not so much in the name of their nation, but rather in the name of their God. So when you include the idea that Israel's army is an army of Zion, a redeemed army, then it seems to indicate a spiritual revival has occurred among the people and warriors of Israel, such that they recognize who it is they are fighting on behalf of. And because they do, they fight ferociously and unafraid. Now, I cannot bypass this without a brief allegorical mention. As believers in Yeshua, knowing who we are living and fighting on behalf of, then ought we not be determined and unafraid? We are not to be timid and fearful, hiding behind the closed doors of our homes and sanctuaries. We have a duty to God, who called us and who saved us. We need to respond and not think we have something to be afraid of. Fear will curtail nearly any worthy task. Fear in a group is like a deadly virus. It's contagious. It spreads. Fear snatches defeat out of the jaws of victory. Countless novels have been penned, Hollywood films made, about those who are so near to victory and overcoming, but they simply can't push themselves over the finish line, and they quit. But sometimes others face the worst opposition, remain determined, and are carried over that finish line nearly miraculously. Over and over in the Bible, we are encouraged to fear not. Stick to your convictions. Speak the truth, even if it brings a cost with it. Carry out your God-given purpose, even though surely you will be oppressed sometimes by those closest to you. These are not Tom Bradford's instructions to you. They are God's. Verse 16 opens with, "On that day." This is a phrase nearly always meaning the end times, the day of judgment, the day of the Lord. It also includes the idea that Israel will finally receive its Davidic king, that is, a king descended from David's royal line. Israel is already an independent nation in our time. So all that's left is for it to change from a democracy to a theocracy. And as regards the end times, we are to understand Yeshua's rule as a king over Israel and the entire earth, not as a typical monarchy, but rather as a theocracy, a nation and a planet ruled by God and his laws and command. Israel is the primary subject of this deliverance, and they are described as a flock. In other words, sheep. This, of course, plays in with the standard shepherd-sheep metaphor for God and his people as is used nearly throughout the Bible. Now, the flock is said to be as gemstones of a crown. The Hebrew for gemstones is abne nezer. Notice the play on the word abne kelah from the previous verse that means stones of a sling or sling stones. So the enemy will be trampled abne kelah, but Israel will be the glorified abne nezer. These two words were chosen so as to play off one another as poetry. Sling stones versus gemstones. Gemstones, which is symbolic of the great value God has for his people and the honor he gives them by being figuratively made part of his king's crown. Now, because Zechariah draws upon other prophets from beginning to end, then it ought not to surprise us that we read this in Isaiah, which he no doubt had in mind, Isaiah 62:3. You will be a glorious crown in the hand of Adonai, a royal diadem held by your God. Now, we probably shouldn't attempt to make anything much deeper than that out of it, since the plain meaning is apparent. Otherwise, we do venture out into allegory. Now, the complete Jewish Bible version of the final verse of chapter 9 is a head-scratcher and frankly shouldn't be considered as accurate. Rather, here is a far better and more literal translation. Zechariah 9:17, how lovely, how beautiful they shall be, producing young men like new grain, young women like new wine. This is nothing less and the announcement of an entrance into a new age. The golden era of Israel has come. Abundance and peace will be the order of the day. This prophetic hope for Israel is found in a few other places in the Bible, but few as memorable as in the book of Numbers. In Numbers 24:5, how lovely are your tents, Jacob, your encampments, Israel. Speaking of young men as abundant as new grain, young women as plentiful as new wine, represents all the elements of fertility and prosperity. See, this kind of summation statement of what has come in the earlier verses telling Israel that the day will come not only for their physical deliverance, but also for their spiritual salvation. And how can we not see the enduring love that God has for his people? I mean, I can never quite decide whether it makes me more sad or angry that the same church that led me to salvation slanders and belittles God's people Israel, as well as God's word, the Bible, and then adds further insult to injury by claiming that the Gentile church now holds all of these blessings and rights and honors that God formerly gave to Israel, but he's gone back on his word and now has transferred them to the church. It's shameful. Let's move on to chapter 10. Open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 10. I want you to follow along with me. Chapter 10, starting in verse 1. Ask Adonai for rain in the spring. Adonai, who makes the rain clouds, and he will give them showers of rain, grass in the field to each one. For the household gods talk nonsense. The diviners have seen a lie. Their dreams convey delusions. The comfort they offer is in vain. Therefore, they go their way like sheep in distress from lack of a shepherd. My anger burns against the shepherds, and I will vent it on the leaders of the flock. For Adonai Zevaot will care for his flock, the people of Judah. He'll make them like his royal war horse. From them come cornerstone and tent peg. From them the bow for battle. From them all the rulers together. They will be like warriors trampling the mud of the streets in battle. They will fight because Adonai is with them. They will rout even those on horseback. I will strengthen the house of Judah, save the house of Joseph. I will bring them back in my compassion for them. They will be as if I hadn't driven them out, for I am Adonai their God, and I will answer them. Ephraim's men will be like warriors. Their hearts will be cheered as if from wine. Their children will see it and rejoice. Their hearts will be glad in Adonai. I will whistle for them and gather them, because I have redeemed them. They will be as numerous as they were before, and I will sow them among the peoples. In distant lands, they will remember me. They will rear their children and then return. I will bring them back from the land of Egypt, gather them out of Asher. I'll bring them into Gilead and the Lebanon until there's no more room for them. Trouble will pass over the sea and stir up waves in the sea. All the depths of the Nile will be dried up. The pride of Asher will be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt will leave. But I will strengthen Israel and Adonai. They will travel here and there in his name. Now, as poetically based as chapter 9 was, chapter 10's only slightly less so. Therefore, the same challenges we faced in chapter 9, we're going to face here. These two chapters are closely related and connected. All the wonderful things promised as the summary of Israel's wonderful destiny given in chapter 9, verse 17, continues in chapter 10. This means that the emotional weight of its words matters as much or more than the historical fact. That is the nature of poetry, no matter which culture writes them. Now, there is no additional promise made in verse 10. Rather, only an expanded vision of the promises previously given is made. But as with all covenants, there is a condition. And although it's a little hard to see it, it appears in the first two verses. It is that these people must approach God in prayer for the blessings to be actualized. And to be clear, this means regular prayer, not just a prayer service to begin the new age of abundance and peace, and then such a practice can be set on the shelf as accomplished and completed. This is meant to impress upon the people that all the goodness of the Lord, all that he wants to give to his people, first begins with obedience and continual communication with him. Praise and thanksgiving are to be ever present. Seeking wisdom in God's will is to be without end. And the only place this knowledge can come from is heaven. Never from idols or magical formulas or pagan seers. Ask of Yehovah. These are the words to begin verse 1. Clear, concise. He is the source of truth and blessing, none other. There is nothing different here than there has ever been. Humanity has just been so slow and resistant to take it up and follow it faithfully. And while this will be Israel's lot in the millennium, it is there for them, for all of us, now. Let's take a lesson from this. It is not that ancient Israel had stopped believing in God, although it is true that as a modern phenomenon, many Jews have stopped believing in God. Is that they stopped approaching him and him alone for their needs. They stopped being obedient to the moral law code he gave them through Moses. Rather, many turned to some hybrid code of men's wisdom, the wisdom of other faiths than God's, and simply what seemed right in their own eyes, along with an ever-growing trove of traditions their religious leaders created for them to follow. It doesn't take a genius to see what happened to Israel and the Jewish people as a result over the centuries. The Constantinian church has done no different, and with the same sorts of outcomes. To ask Yahweh means to see the truth only from him. And that means to seek our morality only from him. And that means there's but one objective morality code for all. He gives us the means to find it in writing, in the form of his Bible, and in the form of prayer. Judaism and the church have often sought it elsewhere and have paid an enormous price for our folly. So to all who are believers, I urge you to heed the motto of the pilgrims and do what is necessary. Revelation 18:4. Then I heard another voice out of heaven and say, "My people, come out of her, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not be infected by her plagues." Do as the venerated pilgrims. Reject human-made doctrines and instead ask Yahweh, even though it's likely to come at a great cost. Ask him in prayer. Ask him in learning and following his word. All of it, not just the part of it that's to the right of that white blank page in our Bibles. One of the really interesting aspects of this ask Yahweh command is that there is no suggestion of any kind of intermediary needed. A worshiper of the God of Israel can go directly, privately to God. One doesn't need a priest or some kind of religious leader as a go-between. In other words, just as the prophets can go directly to God, so can all the people of Israel do the same. Now, realizing that Israel, along with virtually all human societies in the Middle and Far East, were agriculturally based, then the need for rain at the right times was critical. These societies that lived along the major rivers, like the Nile or the Euphrates, used irrigation to water their fields, and so they were less dependent on rain. But Israel was totally dependent on it, and thus even had two words for it in their vocabulary, Matar and Malkosh. Matar is used for the rains that come in the spring. Malkosh is for the later seasonal rains. Thus, verse 1 urges Israelites to ask Yahweh for the rains of spring to come on time, for this is when the grain is ripened for harvest. And the reality is that what we might call the rainy season actually begins in the fall. The spring rains are the last rains of the rainy season. Why ask Yahweh? Because despite the scientific belief that climate variation alone and the hydrologic cycle that comes from it is the determiner of the very existence of rain, Israel is reminded that Yahweh is actually the maker of the clouds, from which falls the rain. Now, it's interesting that the Hebrew word used here, usually rendered as clouds, is chaziz, which more indicates lightning. Probably because most of Israel's rains, not all, result from storms that produce lightning in the clouds. That's probably why this word was chosen. And because God's actions are often depicted as being preceded with lightning and thunder, then this term binds the idea of clouds and an act of God together. So God forms the clouds that produce both lightning and rain showers, and the result is everyone gets the resulting vegetation. Now, some versions, such as the Complete Jewish Bible, use the word grass instead of vegetation. The Hebrew word is aseb, and it's a broad term. And it pretty much just means green plants in general. The Hebrews did not farm grass. They weren't sod farmers. They farmed edible vegetation, grains and the like. So translating aseb to grass is very much out of context. I think we're going to pause here for today and begin with verse 2 next time.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.